And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a good morning, and you're very welcome along to Tuesday's 9 till noon show here on your number one local radio station. It is Highland Radio. It's 4 minutes past nine, and it's Tuesday, the 24th of September. How are you all keeping out there? I mentioned to Lee just before nine, confirmation bias. Which is, you know, when you see a car, that you get a car and then every car seems to be the car you have. It's actually cognitive bias, not confirmation bias. I'm going to be so silly. But anyway, that's what that is. If it was annoying of you that you knew I was wrong but couldn't think of the correct answer. Anyway, 3 hours of keeping you informed and entertained with all the issues of the day from just right here in the Northwest, across the country and beyond. We have Community Garda information coming up at 10 o'clock, just after 10 o'clock. That and so much more besides. Get involved in the conversation. Trigger your own chats. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. 086 60 25,000. If you prefer, you can send a voice note to that number as well on WhatsApp. If you're outside the Republic, it's 00353 86 60 25,000. If you want to give us a telephone call, 07491 25,000. Many of you still prefer to do that. And it's comments at highlandradio.com. And we still, I think once or twice a week, receive letters into the show, which are more than welcome, to the 9 till noon show, Highland Radio, Mountaintop Letterkenny, if that's your thing. And don't forget, if you're listening to the podcast or listening to the overnight replay, feel free to get involved in the conversation, text or WhatsApp, and we should be able to pick them up the following morning so that you can have your say, even if you are not listening live. Now, if you prefer to watch the show, if it suits you, maybe you can throw it up on your big TV, if it's a smart TV, or you have that Fire Stick, many of you have, of course. The YouTube app is on both. You can just load that up and type in Highland Radio Ireland, and you can watch the show and the majority of our guests in that platform as well. We are streaming live across the world on X and on Facebook. Now, the evening news, if you watch, and many of you do, is dominated seemingly on an international scale with what's happening in the Middle East. Israel is now pushing into Lebanon with their rockets and their missiles, and can imagine living in that area. 80,000 odd people received automated phone calls saying effectively that, you know, if you want to stay safe, get out. And it's the same rhetoric or mantra or whatever you want to describe that we're hearing from Israel. They are doing what they want to do, as they did in Gaza, and they are accusing their opponents, in this case Hezbollah, of using residential properties to store munitions, and they're giving prior warning, they would argue, for people to leave. But that being said, you're asking people to leave their homes, people who have done nothing, civilians or what have you. And almost 500 civilians have been killed already in just a couple of days. Many more thousands have been injured. Many of those dead are women and children who have no hand, act or part in anything that's going on over there. And really, it seems the world stands by. Israel is empowered by the unwavering support of the United States and others. And as I say, Israel feel it's done its business and continues to do so in Gaza. And now it's decided to turn its attentions to Lebanon. And it claims it's under attack. But it claims its actions are justified if they believe they may well come under attack. And then once you say that there are arms and weapons in people's residential houses, what effectively you're doing is framing it to say, you know, we can do whatever we want in this situation because we were going to be attacked and people are being used as human shields. So you can just start bombing indiscriminately and people just become numbers. Not to me, not to most people, but that is just how it appears. 4,000 odd injured, 50 children wiped from the face of the planet, never to have a future, 58 women confirmed dead, many more, but that's the confirmed number. It's the front of the Irish Times and many papers. Israel jets pounded Hezbollah targets in Lebanon yesterday, which it's an interesting framing because that's the first sentence of this story. And effectively what it does, and even the media in this country, and I'm not anti-Israel or anti this or anti that, by the way, I'm just saying as a fact, that it's stated as a fact on the first line of this paper that Israel actually pounded Hezbollah targets in Lebanon yesterday. Really, we have no proof of that. We're just taking the Israelis' word on that. We don't know what they were doing, really. We don't know where the bombs landed. We don't know what the targets were. But just in the first line of the front page of one of the most influential papers in the country, it is taken as a fact that Israel is pounding Hezbollah targets. Now, conversely, the Hamas health agency is instantly disregarded as being an unreliable source because it's good Israel, bad Hamas, good Israel, bad Hezbollah, if you know what I mean. And that's just the way that the media portrays it. I'm not saying that's not the case, but I don't like anything just being printed as a statement of fact. I think reporting should be more nuanced. But anyway, Israel jets pounded Hezbollah targets in Lebanon yesterday, killing at least 492 people and injuring more than 1,645. At least 58 women and 35 children were among the dead, according to Lebanon's health ministry. After almost a year of war against Hamas in Gaza on its southern border, Israel is shifting its focus to the northern frontier, where Iran-backed Hezbollah has been firing rockets into Israel in support of Hamas. Now, Hezbollah are different to Hamas. Hezbollah are as well armed as many small countries. They're withholding those arms at the moment, as Israel is, because this is not a full-scale war, and there are certain weapon uses or infringements or whatever it might be that actually trigger what is then a war. So we're at a point where both sides are holding back somewhat because there is hope of some sort of a peace deal. But the Israel Defense Forces said fighter jets attacked more than 1,300 Hezbollah targets, including missiles, launchers, drones, and buildings where it said the Iranian-backed group had concealed rockets. Now, some people from that area have been speaking out saying, my relations house was destroyed, granddad, granny, and the kids wiped off the face of the earth, and they're convinced there was no rockets, launchers, or anything in those houses. Earlier, the IDF made 80,000 calls to residents of the Shia area in southern Lebanon, urging them to leave their homes in areas where it said Hezbollah stores weapons, which in and of itself, too, is an act of... It sows panic in a population amongst those that actually aren't guilty of anything. So if you imagine someone sent a phone call to everybody in Donegal saying that such an organisation was storing weapons in houses in Donegal, everybody get out. Can you imagine if everyone in the county received those messages at the same time? The Irish Independent reports that... how do you fix a problem like people holding on to learner permits perpetually for ages? We talked about this last week. They're booking tests. They're not sitting the tests, and then they just continue to renew their L plates. Well, the plan seems to be to do nothing. Plans for a crackdown on motorists who have held provisional licenses for years and sometimes decades have been delayed. Why? Over fears of a knock-on effect on waiting lists for driving tests. So instead of getting... So we're actually deciding, it seems, as a nation, or whoever's responsible with the RSA, not to crack down on learner drivers because we'd be fearful that they might try and get a test. that's the problem here. A detailed briefing from the Department of Transport said any dramatic change on how many learner permits a person could hold was likely to lead to a surge of applications for driving tests, so people might actually try and be legal. We can't have that. Officials warned this would end up causing extra stress on the already overburdened testing system. And they're probably worried then if they did that, they've hired another 60 or 70 driving testers. They're not going to be online until March or something like that, but they're probably afraid of that benefit being wiped out because people are trying to become legal on the roads. Crazy stuff. The Irish Daily Mail, we got this report to us yesterday via email, and you know, as soon as you read of these special announcements as it relates to a child in danger, you know, it's very, very scary. So we get them into the news emails right around the country, and then, of course, they're printed or published for the wider population. A manhunt was ongoing last night for a hijacker who stole a car with an infant in the back seat in Dublin at lunchtime yesterday. The five-month-old girl was missing for over 2 hours before Gardaí managed to recover her, but the man was still at large last night. Gardaí had issued an urgent Child Rescue Ireland alert just before 4 p.m. yesterday, saying they'd serious concerns that there is an immediate and serious risk to the health and welfare of the girl. It followed an earlier public information alert at around 3 p.m. about a silver Nissan Qashqai hatchback. The baby girl was in the rear of the car when it was hijacked from Mountjoy Square West in Dublin at around 1:50 p.m. It's understood that the hijacker, who was described as white, middle-aged, did not know the child was in the rear of the vehicle and carried out what Gardaí described as an opportunistic crime. So obviously there must have been a point, was there, where the driver of the vehicle was outside of the vehicle, which was open with the child in the back. The CRI alert was cancelled and Gardaí announced that the girl had been found safe and well in Dublin city centre along with the vehicle. Speaking at a Garda briefing in the Phoenix Park yesterday evening, Superintendent Liam Geraghty said the suspect in this case is best described at this stage as a white middle-aged male wearing dark clothing and a baseball cap. There's a few questions to be answered in that story. But probably questions that aren't appropriate just right about now. The Irish Daily Star tells us that Taoiseach Simon Harris has confirmed that developers could be prevented from taking on future state contracts amid further delays to the National Children's Hospital. I read this because this one jumped out at me, not least because it's a big story, but a few people texted in yesterday and said, well, you know, how can you tender for a contract, win that contract, not perform as you should, and then win another contract? And that was a point that was made by a few of you yesterday. So the public know what's going on, right? Well in advance often of what the legislators do. They're saying, hold on a second, something doesn't make sense here. And now maybe the penny's dropping with those that have the power to make sure this doesn't happen again. Well, this move comes as the chair of the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board is expected to make strong criticisms of BAM to TDs and senators. In a letter to the Taoiseach last Friday, Health Minister Stephen Donnelly told Mr. Harris and other coalition leaders that the beleaguered project would be delayed for the 14th time. It was expected that the hospital would be handed over to Children's Health Ireland in February 25 for a six-month fit-out. In his letter seen by the Star, Mr. Donnelly said that NPHDB believes that BAM's approach is based on extracting as much money from the Irish taxpayer as possible. Now, there's another report out today about the preparedness for Children's Health Ireland to actually function within that hospital and to run it. And that in and of itself is also incredibly worrying. And I fear there's going to be delay after delay after delay. The Daily Mirror reports that a former Sinn Féin press officer was placed on the sex offenders register yesterday after he pleaded guilty to 14 child sex charges. Michael Jared McMonagall, 42, who was found unconscious in his home in Limewood Street, Derry, last Thursday, has admitted committing the offences on various dates between May 2020 and August 21. The length of time he'll spend on the register will be determined when he's sentenced on November 8th for the offences he had originally denied. At his re-arraignment before Judge Neil Rafferty at Derry Crown Court, McMonagall pleaded guilty to one charge of attempting to incite a girl under the age of 13 to engage in sexual activity. I will not go into the full details of that, but it was for sex, effectively. And another of attempting to incite another child under the age of of 16 to engage in a sex act. He also admitted 12 charges of attempting to sexually communicate with children for the purpose of obtaining sexual gratification. He had originally denied the charges. The judge warned him that he might expect a custodial sentence. We'll see how long that is. And I'll watch with interest. But there you go. That's that story. And finally, and this is completely trivial compared to some of the stuff we've been talking about, but RTE is looking for the new Bambi thug, effectively. But I don't understand this. Like, I mean, I understand RTE's charged with this, but as you would know, at the moment, there's an Irish Music Month competition that's ongoing. And we have a fantastic act that's going into the final 21. And we wish the lads the very best. Tessio, that is, of course. There's 21 final acts from all around the country at the moment, from all independent radio stations. And the top six of those will go to a live grand final. And then there's a winner announced. Wouldn't it be fair or better if maybe, you know, I'm not saying take it off RTE altogether, but why not use the winner of the independent radio competition 1 year and then RTE the next, the independents 1 year, RTE the next. And that means that, you know, RTE are going to try another Bambi thug buzz. It might be another Bambi thug buzz that wins the independent radio competition, but why not use that entrant to go and represent Ireland? At least we might get a different style and see what works. But anyway, RTE is looking for an act to represent Ireland in Eurovision 25. After the success of this year's Bambi Thug, artists, performers and songwriters are being urged to contact the station if they feel they have the talent to succeed. RTE Eurovision's Michael Keeley said, Bambi Thug came sixth in Malmo, Ireland's best result since 2000. Bambi performed Electric Picnic last month and is on a tour across Europe with sold-out shows in Dublin and Galway. So if you want to get in touch with them, you need to do it right now. The closing date for participants is November 18th. The 69th Eurovision Song Contest will take place in Basel, Switzerland in May. All right, so maybe that's your thing, or maybe it's not. We are joined on the programme now by Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Greg. Good morning.
Thanks for chatting to us. Right, you and your sister went for a walk at the weekend. Talk us through what happened.
So we met up and we decided we would go to Drumbull Woods with the children. So I had my three children with me and she has two. So one of hers is a baby in a pram. So we went for the walk through the woods and like we did meet a lot of people walking and people walking with dogs, no leads on their dogs. Mm-hmm. And now when we got back to the car, we just done the walk around by the river and back and we got back to the car. So the pram, the wheels were covered with dog poo, my sister's shoes and two of the children's. Like we were just disgusted. And only for we had bottles of water, a packet of wipes in the car. And we spent like a good bit of time cleaning shoes before we could get into our car, you know. And I just thought it wasn't a pleasant experience.
No, far from it. And it's also unsafe, especially with young kids.
Yeah.
I know myself, and there was a distant family member who came into contact with dog poo and lost the vision in one of their eyes. It's no joke, like it has serious consequences.
And like children in the woods, like they're picking up things, they're picking up leaves and sticks and everything like that, and you don't know what they're picking up.
Yeah, and it's about responsible dog ownership. I mean, do you have issues? What was the experience like with the dogs without leads on? I've had an awful lot of this in the last couple of weeks, Amanda, and it's people, their dogs running up to you, and particularly toddlers, and they think it's cute. And I don't.
The children also go up to the dogs.
Mm.
Yeah. No, we didn't have any issues with that. Now the dogs did come up to the children, and the children were over the dogs.
But
you just can't trust the dog either. Like, but it was just the mess on the shoes when we got back. You know, and I've been talking to other people yesterday, and who've had similar experiences, like in Drumbull Woods as well. You know, and a lot of people would use the woods for walking. And, you know, I drive through there a few mornings, you know, in the week, and there's a lot of cars parked. So a lot of people use that, you know, and it's not clean, like it's not safe.
And you said effectively you spent more time cleaning the dog poo off your shoes and prams than you actually did trying to enjoy the walk.
Yeah, than the actual walk. Yeah, it definitely would put me off going back there. So it would.
Yeah, I can imagine. So the message is, pick up after your dogs. I mean, because you're not an anti-dog person, and that's coming across loud.
This is about the mess
that's not being picked up.
That's just the mess, You don't mind dogs. Like, people are entitled to walk their dogs in the woods as well. Like, it's just clean up after them. You know, there's children and other people using the woods as well. And, like, you know, just be mindful that there's children there and they're picking up things and they're, you know, it's just, you know, it's there for everyone to use.
Mm. Pram covered, shoes covered, the kids' shoes covered.
Yeah. Only we did have the water in the car and the wipes, you know.
I'd have made you walk home, Amanda.
I know.
Was it so bad that it would discourage you from using this, you know, community facility again, I wonder, Amanda?
It definitely would now, because like the children, if they had just got into the car, like your car's covered as well.
Yeah, of course.
Only for we noticed it on the wheels of the pram, and then we started checking shoes. You know, and then cleaning them. Like, we spent a lot of time cleaning the shoes.
And look at, I mean, we don't have to get into the nitty gritty while people might be eating the cornflakes, but you know, you can get off the stuff that's on the shoes, but there's tread and stuff in on the pram, and unless you had a scrubbing brush with you, you're not going to get rid of all of it. And it's unfortunate, isn't it?
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. So the simple, it's a very, very simple request. And that is, if you're out walking your dog, enjoy your dog. Amanda doesn't mind you going out with your dog, but please pick up the poo after.
Just clean up the mess,
And I don't think any dog owner would want to be responsible for what you went through, or particularly, God forbid, if a child was damaged because of this stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. That's it. All right, we'll see what other people say. Amanda, thank you.
All right, thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Okay, that's Amanda there helping us highlight that issue. I presume it's not something exclusive to Drumbo Woods, but is that an experience that you've had or you can share? Let us know. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. A caller says, I spent most of my life in London and I lived in a mainly Jewish area. Many of the people were born in Israel. They were the most polite people that you would ever meet. I wouldn't be the easiest person to get on with, and they never argue with you. They are such peaceful, polite people, and I really don't understand what's going on in Israel. And what is going on in Israel, and I mean, we'll never forget too, of course, the awful atrocity that was delivered on the Israeli people on October 7th last year, and the fact that some of those people that were literally dragged from a festival or from a house or from a village are still captive in Gaza and should be released as well. And one couldn't condemn enough the actions of Hamas on October 7th. But all that being said, there also has to be a proportionate response. And what Israel has been doing of late and is beginning to do now in Lebanon, albeit that it's saying it's defending itself, and some people will say that's its right. But that's like, it feels a little bit like me walking down Letterkenny Main Street and someone looks at me and me going punching him in the face, and my argument is, well, he was going to have a go at me. You know, that seems to be what, on a much important, much more bigger scale, what Israel are doing. They think someone's going to attack them, so they attack back. Now, of course, since they began their operations in Gaza, Hezbollah has been firing rockets and drones on the northern front. So they could argue that that's the reason why. But as I say, I think all responses should be somewhat proportionate, should they not? We were speaking to a guy yesterday, Chris, I believe his name was, and he was coming back on a train from, effectively, I think he was in Port Rush, and he was travelling back to Derry. And he says that many cultures and many people of different backgrounds were represented on that train. But one gentleman, who might be well known, I'm not sure, is one of those people that preaches and carries boards with biblical verses on it. And he says that train staff declined him entry to the train. And effectively, our listener Chris says, you know, was it Chris? Maybe it was John. But anyway, he said that, you know, can you be a Christian open and publicly in this country any longer? This caller says, very interesting listening to this gentleman. It's true the most persecuted people in the world are Christian, and it has been happening for quite a long time. In Ireland, Christians are almost afraid to stand up or speak out of fear of backlash. Christians are being killed in Africa and India. It's very rarely reported, they say. Another, in the age of tolerance, equality, diversity and inclusion, everyone is welcome, except, of course, Christians, it seems. And the preacher was getting on the train to preach. Everyone else was getting on minding their own business, not showing their religion, shoving their religion down everyone's throats. That's why he was denied access to the train. But I mean, like, there are people could counter argue that and say that if you have, you know, if you're wearing items of clothing that, you know, are very expressive of your religion, that some could argue, I'm not saying it's the case, that that is shoving your religion down other people's throats, or maybe it's just going about your life. I'm not sure if he was getting on the train to preach or not, but anyway, he didn't get on. Right, we'll be back with more very shortly. Now, new figures show that femicide, which is the killing of women and girls, are on the rise in Ireland. The research team examined the 97 gender-based killings of women or girls referred for formal forensic post-mortem examinations from 2012 to 23, and 96 died at the hands of a male perpetrator. A new study has found cases increased from 19% referred to the Office of the State Pathologist between 2012 and 2020 to 29% from 2021 to 2023. Just over half, 56% of women were killed by a current or former intimate partner. 20% were killed by family members, with women killed by their son in 13% of cases. Four femicides occurred in each of the counties of Donegal, Kerry, Kilkenny, Mayo and Meath over the 12-year period. Dr. Marie Hainsworth is the manager of the Donegal Domestic Violence Centre and is with me now in the show. Thanks for joining us, Marie. I do appreciate you taking your time.
No, morning, and thanks for having me on, though.
Yes, and I think, you know, this research really confirms perhaps what people like you and those involved in domestic violence services perhaps already could see happening.
Yeah, it is a sad reflection, I suppose, but it is a reality. And I think we've been pushing for this for quite a long time, that there needs to be specific domestic homicide reviews, you know, like they have in the UK, for example, where after every incident like this happens, there is a kind of a deep investigation to discover. It's not about apportioning blame, but it's about trying to understand what were the factors that led up to this and are there commonalities that were missing, you know, that might highlight and be used in risk assessment for domestic cases. Because I think, you know, on that report you were looking at, only 50% of them had a prior history of physical violence, you know, so that's not a main indicator in terms of what domestic abuse cases can lead to, the, you know, to a homicide. So we need to look at other factors. And we do know, for example, that in nearly 98% of domestic homicides, coercive control is a definite factor. So that's something we've learned from this piece, not from this particular piece of work, but from work in this area over the time. So we need to look at more things like that. We need to come up with more patterns, and we need to have more information about what is actually happening here.
I mean, you could, on the face of it, seem that we're being quite proactive in terms of, you know, Garda training in dealing with these types of cases, the introduction of legislation as it relates to coercive control, and legislation covering other acts of violence which are more often perpetrated against women, yet we are still seeing increases. So I wonder what's missing there.
I think it's the risk assessment element of it. It's the prevention piece, you know. And it's all right talking about awareness raising. That's a very kind of low level kind of, you know, strategy. We need to be, this is where I keep going back to the, because it's not just adult victims. I mean, within that period of time, there was also 20 children that were murdered through domestic related, you know, they either witnessed the assault and were also attacked. And those figures are not being published. So it's not just adult victims that are affected here. And state agencies are working constantly with families in crisis and in this kind of a potential situation. So our handling on it needs to get better at that level. You know, there's a lot of families out there living at a high level of risk. And I don't think, you know, like it is an inevitability that it's going to keep happening. You know, we currently have, it's just under, you know, I think it's one homicide every 6 weeks in this country where a woman is killed. And that pattern hasn't really shifted too much. The reason the femicide rates have gone up is because all the other areas of homicide have actually come down. So it's the overall percentage now of femicides is becoming more and more a majority. So, you know, something is not working here that we need to look at.
And we can draw comparisons with countries, you know, with a similar setup to us, if I could put it like that. And the research also looked at the level of violence against women, extreme acts of violence during the pandemic, prolonged lockdowns and what have you. And some countries saw no increases, others did. And Ireland was amongst some of those countries that did record a rise in extreme domestic violence or extreme acts of violence against women. So that's something definitely we need to look at and gives us an opportunity to say, well, what are we doing that other countries aren't or vice versa?
Yeah, and the other thing that happened as well is that straight after the pandemic, we did see a big rise in femicides in that particular year. 2022 was significantly higher than any of the previous years or even last year. So, you know, something definitely was a trigger point there that meant that possibly one of the things that is working for women is that they are able to get out and about and get the support of a community. And maybe that's a mitigating factor that actually when lockdown came down, those supports were missing then. And that clearly had a big impact, particularly in this country.
And I think it's worth emphasising as well, because it is an important statistic, or it feels important to me, is that of all the femicides we talk of, 6% of the cases, just 6% of the cases, the perpetrator was not known to the victim. Is that telling in any way, shape or form? Does that leave us maybe, and it sounds a strange way to put it, but in a better position to try and tackle this? Because we can see from where these awful crimes are coming from. So we should be able to be more proactive in tackling it.
Yeah, but unfortunately, it also means that the vast majority of them occurred in a place where not many people are going to have access.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reason why a lot of, you know, attacks in the street can be preempted, you know, is there are other people around that can jump in. But obviously, in a domestic setup, there often is just the perpetrator and the victim, and sometimes children, and that's it. There's nobody else. Nobody's likely to just walk in on the scenario and be of assistance. So it does leave it, you know, you're totally dependent on the victim being able to reach and access help, or neighbours being able to call. But if you're living in a rural location, you, as a neighbour, you're not going to hear something necessarily. So that's another risk factor, unfortunately. Yeah.
So you talk of awareness being a I can't remember exact phrase you use, but a low level action or what have you. I'm not questioning whether that's the case or not, but just I'll frame it like this. We've spoken many times over the years, Marie, about how often there are patterns of behavior, right? So instances may begin to happen in a house, or someone can become violent and it escalates, and often then it's not always the case, but there are often points where if there were intervention, we'd never get as far as the femicide or the murder or the very serious assault. So what can we be doing more? Obviously, I think in terms of getting awareness, maybe people might approach services like yours earlier in a pattern of violence, but there must be points of intervention that we're missing out on, or maybe there isn't, but it feels like there must be to me.
Yeah, and I'm not saying awareness raising isn't, you know, like when I meant low level, I meant in terms of where you've got families that are at a, you know, a kind of a turning point or almost at that brink of, you know, the situation escalating, that the low level awareness raising is for a different target group, if you like. And it is definitely really important. I think one of the interventions, and we are actually coming into doing that in Donegal now, is to have a perpetrator program. Mm. So moves that actually work in the rest of the country but have not yet been present in Donegal are actually now going to set up in conjunction with probation and a number of other services to look at perpetrators actually going onto a program that will work with them. You know, this is for men who want to look at and explore ways in which maybe violence is not the most appropriate way for them to manage situations in a domestic relationship. So, you know, at least when you've got interventions like that, where we are directly talking to the perpetrator, really, you know, the person responsible, we need to be having more conversations about violence and about how it's not a tool that should be used and what are the consequences. And I think that's a bit more hardcore than your generic awareness raising, which is mainly around, you know, positive relationships and, you know, equality within relationships and all of that, which is definitely also needed. But mm-hmm. we also need to have specific conversations about violence and why it's used as a tool and why perpetrators feel it's an okay tool to use, because they clearly do. And we need to not shy away from that conversation. So that's one piece. And then the other piece is there does need to be better risk assessment, you know, where we know there are vulnerable families, where we know violence is being used repeatedly, that we begin to put in place interventions that acknowledge that. And that includes not exposing children to that level of violence. You know, yeah. I think there seems to be, it doesn't really seem to be taken that seriously when it comes to a child protection level. You know, it seems it's the adult victim needs to get out, but we keep the children in it, you know, whether it's through access, whether it's through continual contact. We don't put the same level of, I think, awareness around the risks that children face.
How important is it that it becomes available that, you know, people can check if prospective partners, be they male or female, have a violent past? I think there is those types of options in Northern Ireland, and people wish to see them extended to the Republic.
Yeah, and I think that is definitely something that's useful. But you're looking at the fact that, you know, particularly for very young people, you know, entering maybe their first relationship, yeah. there probably isn't a prior history, you know. And we do know that a lot of femicides, particularly involving stabbings, for example, occurs in the younger generation, you know, it's under 35s. There might not be that history. But we also, you know, certainly when you're moving up in age and somebody has got experience and they've got prior convictions as well, they would need to have convictions for domestic abuse. And that's, you know, it takes a long time for cases sometimes to get into courts and, you know, what is going to be recorded, what isn't. It's a complicated. I don't know that we have the infrastructure to do that quite yet, but it's definitely something we, you know, people should be able to make, you know, those kind of assessments. But also, I mean, there are plenty of people around who know what other people are saying about the relationships and prior relationships. And it's very easy to say, oh, but that was then. And, you know, he's a changed person now. It's not the same. You know, we've had
we tend to almost, you know, brush over things and look for the best in people, even in the most severe circumstances. I don't know that if that talks to a sort of a societal attitude or if that even needs to change.
And I think it comes back to that conversation about understanding violence, because we do tend to make excuses. You know, it's because somebody has poor mental health or because they have an addiction. We never say, oh, this person uses violence as a choice. Mm. And that, unfortunately, is the conversation we need to have, because if somebody's using violence as a choice, that will continue from relationship to relationship until it's challenged. And that's the kind of red flag that you need to be looking at, as well as the controlling behaviour. I mean, coercive control is always present in a domestic homicide. So that is definitely an indicator that people can look for. You know, is there a sense of fear? Do people feel afraid in the relationship? You know, do they have to be back at a certain time, or do they feel like they're walking on eggshells? And what happens if they don't do something? If people are saying that they feel afraid or know that they have to do something, then that is definitely a red flag and a concern.
Yeah, and so often people, by choice or because they haven't realised yet, confuse coercive control with passion, love, you know, things like that. But eventually the penny does drop. You just hope it's not before it is too late. I know the likes of Donegal Domestic Violence Services and the other services that we have, Lifeline and others across Donegal, do everything they can. Everyone is listened to and assisted as much as impossible as is possible. Would increased funding of services like yours, Marie, help if we're trying to sort of maybe get people out of situations before they escalate, or you talk about, you know, protecting children from some of these environments? I'm just wondering if more investment in domestic violence services might also help.
A little bit, and also I think investment into it's mainly the housing sector that is the problem, because if we had places where people could go, you know, even to get out of a relationship for a while, to make plans, to think about things, to keep people safe, you know, to have a bit of space to work out what needs to happen next. Because that's a key thing for a lot of families. In order to escape domestic abuse, usually their finances are tied up with the perpetrator, their housing is tied up with them. You know, they can't actually move on in their lives until they've got a bit of space to be able to make decisions. And the housing crisis, unfortunately, is causing a lot of people to stay in situations that's not ideal and could potentially be quite dangerous. So definitely that needs to be the investment. I'm not saying that we need to take on those houses, but we do need to work closely with, say, local authorities, and housing department generally needs to invest a lot more into this area. I know they're putting in place some refuge spaces, but we need all sorts of accommodation options.
Okay, Dr. Marie Hainsworth, thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it. That's Dr. Marie Hainsworth, the manager of the Donegal Domestic Violence Centre. If you have a view on that, let us know. 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 074 91 25,000. Councillor Albert Doherty is with me on the programme now. Good morning, Albert. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning, listeners.
Right, yeah. We're back talking about respite services at River Walk House in Carndonagh. The HSC had committed that services would be reinstated in March of this year. Then they said it would be September this year. And yet here we are. We are in the mouth of October, effectively, and yet these services are not in place as they should be. What's going on?
Yeah, I received assurances to my question in the May meeting that, an earlier meeting, that the May area was a selected date for the return and the restoration of respite services at Riverwalk. That was then delayed until September, with the proviso that if staff were obtained in the meantime, it would be reinstated, recommenced earlier. And on Friday of last week, I've now received confirmation that it could be the last quarter of 2024, and that the HR and the disability services are working towards the recommencing. And that's just not satisfactory, and it's very distressing and upsetting for families who were awaiting the restoration and the recommencement of services here. at Riverwalk.
What does ongoing staffing issues mean? Does that mean they're trying to recruit but can't? Does that mean that the staff that they have are too busy elsewhere? What does ongoing staffing issues mean?
Well, what they've confirmed on Friday last is that outstanding there are two nursing posts to be recruited, and in addition to that, two healthcare assistant posts have to be recruited. Now, what concerns me as well is that the HSE recruitment process, they say that all necessary approvals to recruit are being followed up. And I believe the approvals issue should be long time resolved in relation to the restoration and the recommencement of the services. And today, my colleague, Councillor McMonagall, will be raising this issue at today's meeting of the Regional Health Forum in relation to Riverwalk, but also in relation to other areas throughout the county of Donegal. And it's been raised by the Children's Disability Network team. Often for initial people, they are offered Ballymacool Respite House services. I'm advised that Ballymacool stretched to the limit. And indeed, one family from the north initial area in Clonmany was offered one day respite in Mount Charles. And that was a day's organising travel to Mount Charles, 66 miles away, 130 something return. And that isn't the service that is merited to be available to people here in Inishowen and in the rest of Donegal, and something needs to happen.
But if they couldn't staff these services in March and they couldn't staff these services in September, there's absolutely nothing that would give us trust that this can happen in the last quarter of this year. This feels a little bit like sitting in a car with a child and they're saying, are we there yet?
Yeah, and it's very pointedly noticed that in their response to me on Friday, the HR recruitment point out that a position was filled in the June-July period, a nursing post position, and for some reason that person withdrew her application or his application, and now no longer wanted. So there is an issue. HR and the Disability Service said they have tried in partnership with each other to actively progress a number of recruitment initiatives. As you point out, these seemingly are not working. This needs to be looked at. And I just noticed there where the Northwest Regional Assembly mentioned recently that in relation to government and department services in the Northwest, there needs to be a policy of positive discrimination in the Northwest and in Donegal to deliver regional equality. And our health service is not delivering regional equality, I believe, people.
I mean, obviously, then, there's arguments for similar measures for those working in Dublin because the increased of living there. That's complicated. As obvious a solution it might seem, it is quite complicated. That being said, I do believe that the methods would change to try and fill vacancies in CDMP roles. So there might be a precedent there. But I think, you know, this talks to a wider issue here as to, I think, why does it seem such an unattractive job? Why is it so hard to recruit? Is it particular to this area? Is it particular to this area of this area? Are these situations happening elsewhere? Are there any other measures that have been taken in any other areas that have proved successful in recruiting? You know, because I think the HSE also has to take blame for being unable to recruit. You know, I don't think them not able to recruit is the actual excuse for not having these services. We need to shine a light on the HSE and say, well, what is the problem? Why would someone accept the position, go through a procedure, the acceptance, or not the acceptance, but what you used a phrase there, the pre-employment clearance, go through that and then not take the job? Why not? Was that person asked why they didn't? Is that public information?
Oh, yes. Pointedly, the response reads that there was one post for a nursing post accepted, subsequently withdrew acceptance of the post. So there is an issue to be addressed from within. And from within, I want to see the approval process hastened so that applications required and jobs required can be filled. But if we have to look at the training and perhaps the attractiveness to travel to other areas, having trained our nurses, we need to look at that. Mm. And also, if it has to be with conditions and salary, whatever, I believe that merits consideration by the powers that be as well.
Well, something has to be done for this listener. I haven't had respite for my daughter in 6.5 years. In the past, we had no house and no staff. Now we have the house and no staff. It's ridiculous, and they feel no one is listening. No respite for 6.5 years. Now, what are the implications on the principal caregiver there in terms of their emotional, mental and physical well-being? You know, these are people we should be supporting in doing the work of the state, often in caring for people. Very high level, very intense care. And we're not even providing them the basic luxury, if I could call it that, and I say that with my tongue in my cheek, of a day's local respite. It's crazy. It's completely unacceptable. To me, it's unacceptable.
And how do I feel myself? I have been that person's messenger to HSC, to HR, and seemingly to no positive avail so far. And from her family members and others that I've talked to, they feel abandoned in relation to having some respite time for themselves or for their families.
They have been abandoned. Indeed. Right, well, we'll see what response is given to your colleague a little later.
As I say, it'll be raised today, and yeah. I've asked the Deputy McLaughlin as well to ensure that Mr. Donnelly and Mr. Burke are made aware of the issues here in the North West.
Well, March, you know, it slipped. September, it slipped. Last quarter this year, possible. I mean, there's no end in sight, really, if the truth be told, because we can't have any confidence in the latest deadline because the previous two have slipped. But I appreciate you helping us raise the issue. That's Councillor Albert Doherty there. If that's a story that affects you, please get in touch with us, because the more I hear, the more I can track down the minister with responsibility and articulate and help getting these stories to that person. Back with more after the news and obituary notices. In fact, we return with Community Garda information.